This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Worried about prices at the pump? Or is it still way too cheap to save a livable climate? Even big fossil fuel executives wonder if we'll find enough energy or retain an economy to pay for it. In just a minute, we'll encounter a powerful mind who drove through the options and calculations to arrive at surprising conclusions about powering the future. I'm Alex Smith. Later in this program, we'll talk with Dr. Rose Corey, lead author of a newly published paper. She found another surprise agent whipping up the production of greenhouse gases in the far north. It's yet another positive feedback loop in the rapidly changing Arctic. That empire of permafrost is disappearing quickly. Scientists estimate 10 to 20% will melt in this century alone. The latest research says just 1.5 degrees centigrade over pre-industrial levels will tip the permafrost into a vast melting process no one can stop, unleashing more carbon dioxide than we have in the atmosphere now. That is a recipe for climate disaster unseen for millions of years. We are already halfway there. I'll also play you a new song from an upcoming tour of North America and Britain by a hot new Australian band. It's good green music for your ears. But first, this in-depth conversation with a surprising mind about your energy future.
Social conditions, no one will openly visit. The atrocious revisions of our father's decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
Everyone knows our civilization is doomed and our kids will be digging through the rubble for cans of dog food. Apparently, Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin missed the memo. He wrote the book Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow. Laughlin is the Bass Professor of Physics at Stanford University, where he has taught since 1985. In 1998, he shared the Nobel Prize for Physics. His previous books are Crime of Reason and A Different Universe. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I read the book. I've called Robert up to argue with him, and that's a big mistake because he's smarter than I am. And anyway, it's a trap. Robert Laughlin wants us to argue with him. Robert Laughlin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This should be fun.
It could be. The old saying, you know, is that you shouldn't jump to conclusions, but I think that's exactly what you started out doing by writing this book. Didn't you presume we will find the energy we need in the future and then try to figure out how?
I did. But of course, you appreciate that some fraction of this text is black humor. I myself think that the transition from here to there is very likely to be quite awful. But I decided that I could target a business audience better if I skipped that and talked about what's eventually going to happen, because the correct thinking about what to do begins with what will be.
Well, as I told you, Robert, in email, I stewed over this book thinking, well, he hasn't counted on an economic crash, and where is the climate damage? What is your response to that?
Oh, I think both are very likely to happen. But my timing is a little different from most people concerned about the climate. I think that the energy shortages are likely to happen first. And so that's where I put my emotional energy. It's behind that part of the problem. Now, the damage that you're doing to the environment is real. It's harder to measure, so harder to get consensus on it. But everybody knows the CO2 is going up, and that has implications.
But you just decided to bypass that and said, all right, well, what would the future look like anyway? Is that right?
I did. Well, you see, we live in the middle of a grand mal political dysfunctional conversation about this, that it has to do with the difficulty of understanding things. So you've got one set of people who think doom is upon us in less than a century, and you have another set of people who think the doom is not upon us and the whole thing is a fiction. Now, I look at the facts and I see something in between. So I think that the human race dying off completely isn't what's going to happen. I do think that a lot of it could have trouble. So the right-wing view that there is going to be no trouble, I don't think is correct. And I also don't think that the end of the human race is correct. When there isn't enough of something, what human beings usually do is fight over it. So what I tell people when I'm in talks about this is that what we're really discussing is the safety of your progeny, whether they're going to have to fight or not. And you have to decide whether you want to invest now to protect them. They don't exist yet. In fact, they won't exist for many decades. They haven't been born. So, and you'll be gone by that time. So the question is whether you want to act now to help them or not.
So let's say we give you and humanity the benefit of those rather large doubts you've expressed. You do presume that oil and gas and even coal will run out. We all know that's going to happen. And I want to talk to you about the energy solutions that we might employ. But first, I think you need to tell us a little bit more about what power really is, and it's not just what comes out of the wall socket. I was impressed about your discussion of how little power there really is in a transmission line at any one time. Do you want to talk to us about how finely balanced that system is?
Sure. This is, of course, technicalities about the electric lines. Electric lines, by their nature, are simply transmission lines, like hydraulic lines. And the way they work is that somewhere on the other end of them, where you can't see, there's a generator somewhere. And the fact that you plugged in your apparatus or switched on your light, that information propagates backwards down the line at the speed of light and shows up as an extra load on the generator. And then the people who are manning the generator then adjust it to keep the line voltage up. So this is an aspect of electricity that a lot of people don't understand, that it really is fossil fuel. Electricity is not different from fossil fuel. Somewhere at the other end of the line is the generator. You just can't see it. This, in turn, affects the whole conversation about the wind and sun. Why? Well, because electricity is valuable because you can get it when you want it. Right now, this is only possible because the people at the other end have a big tank of fossil fuel that they can burn whenever they wish. When you start talking about the wind and sun, that's not true, because the wind and sun are intermittent. They don't come when you call. We know from electricity events in the past that the true market value of electricity varies by a factor of over 10 between high demand and low demand. In other words, the electricity that you're willing to pay for most is the electricity you can't get. And that is, for example, on a very hot day when you just must have the air conditioner on. So the whole idea of replacing the electricity supply with renewable sources has this little problem with it, that it can't work without a massive storage apparatus. And this apparatus does not yet exist.
Well, that does apply, because if we got, you know, the late night talk show host Jay Leno out talking with Americans, as you pointed out in your book, I doubt he could find anyone who's heard of Andesol 1. What is that, and why is it too bad Americans don't know about it?
This is a solar plant in Spain built by a German company based on principles that were made in USA. So it's kind of a fascinating three-ring circus. I stumbled upon the facts of it as a side effect of writing this book. The astonishing thing is that it's not in the U.S. press at all, but it is in the European press. This is one of the great disadvantages Americans have of being monolingual. Why it has no press in this country, I'm a little baffled by. There are, as of this moment, 11 such plants built. They're not that big, 50 megawatts, but it's clear Spanish capitalists decided that it was workable and decided to fund them. There are more, actually. They're happening quietly in places like Morocco. Now, what's so neat about it is that they lick the storage problem. I was writing this book, and I said, well, everyone knows you can't store electricity except by pumping water uphill, but I checked it. And what I discovered is I was wrong, that nobody bothered to tell these German guys, so they just did it. Now, it is specifically designed for the sun and specifically designed for solar thermal, which, as you know, has got problems, at least in North America, problems that are caused, who knows, probably by Chinese currency shenanigans. But in any event, they certainly have problems. Well, thinking this through, I realized that you could do it with the wind, too. And not only that, but it's by far the best way to actually do it.
And what is that storage?
Well, you do it with heat. And now we have the catch-22 of being a technical man. You see, it came in a flash to me that you could do this, so I made a patent. And right now, I'm busy trying to get the capital together to do it. It turns out I'm a doer, and so you see a problem, you fix it. This particular issue, of course, is complicated by the divvying up of the energy markets. Alternate energy is always complicated because it involves government subsidies, and those are always a little dirty. And the amount of money that you have to cough up to be serious about electricity is very large. However, the technical specs came rolling out, and it's straightforward. I'm enough convinced that it's the right solution to the problem that I'm putting my own hours and cycles on it now. And with luck, pray for me that we get the dollars to line up. By God, I can do it.
Well, you know, I think our listeners are still wondering, well, what did they do at Andesol 1? I mean, what's the secret?
Oh, good point. Well, when you're storing energy, the short answer is they put the energy in heat, and they stored it in salt. Why salt? No particular reason, except that it's really runny. And turns out, for getting the heat in and out, you want something that's not viscous. It's really runny, and it's molten in the region, the temperature region, that is high, but not so high that it melts steels. There is a large literature on this whole subject that comes out of the nuclear reactor industry, it turns out. So the use of salts is for heat media is well known. So what these folks did is they borrowed the design concept of Solar 2 and actually scaled it up and built it as a way to stash the energy. So the idea is that you heat up some medium with the energy. You put the energy in the form of heat, and then you stash that. You sort of stash this hot stuff. And then when you're ready to make electricity out of it, you pull the hot stuff out of it and run a turbine with it. Now, the thing that's important about these plants that happened in Spain is that they got the economics right. So you know that the fact that it multiply deployed means that you've got a cost structure there that makes sense. With the proviso that the Spanish government had very high guaranteed prices for the electricity made. That's, of course, always a bone of contention. But the point is all those costs are laid out enough that you know what they are. And they're rather wonderful, actually. What my friends and I figured out was that if you chopped off the solar field and just made the storage by itself, the cost goes way down, and what you've got is functionally a battery. But a battery that isn't environmentally hazardous, and it wears like iron, and it's real cheap. Now, I'm sorry, I'm getting too excited because this is my favorite subject. But anyway, did I answer your question?
You sure did. And I liked your answer, and I want to buy one of your batteries. So you got me. Now, in your book, Powering the Future, you also describe a planet with a very cold, dark surface under tremendous pressure where we could develop using robotic technology, but we don't need any spaceships. Where is that, and what could we do there?
Oh, that's right here on Earth. That's at the bottom of the ocean. You appreciate that this chapter I wrote before any of the BP disasters at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico occurred. So I knew that there were lots of advanced robotics used at the bottom of the ocean by the oil industry. And I wanted to talk about that as part of the larger vision. Lots of people want to stash energy at the bottom of the ocean. And so I wanted to put some numbers on that and sort of to explain how you would do it. My guess is that actually it'll be too expensive, okay, to do that. And then it'll wind up centuries from now being stashed on the surface of the Earth, and my bet says heat. However, if you wanted to put it at the bottom of the ocean, out of sight, out of mind, it's perfectly doable because the means you have are there. The neat thing is the instrumentalities for doing it are not your own bodies. They can't be because human beings can't take the pressure down there, and they never will be able to. The pressure vessels you need to protect yourself are just too bulky and unwieldy and expensive. However, robots have no problem with it. And if you saw the movies of the wellhead of Deepwater Horizon getting fixed by robots, and you know that these robots are pretty neat, and they're perfectly happy down there in this horribly high-pressure, horribly cold environment. So the future sort of is already here. It's just not in the public consciousness. oil people use these robotics daily, and the people who drive them are on the surface basically with artificial bodies at the bottom of the ocean doing work.
I was intrigued with your explanation of deep sea air pressure storage of energy, and then I thought, well, could we do it with carbon dioxide instead and maybe solve two problems in one?
Sure. In fact, people are talking about that. It's hypersensitive, of course, because lots of people who want sequestration of carbon dioxide, what they really want is you don't make the carbon dioxide in the first place. So there's a literature on this, and people are discussing putting it down there. The carbon dioxide will absorb very nicely down the bottom of the ocean. But then you've polluted the bottom of the ocean. Okay? So do you really want to do that? So there are people on both sides of that issue. Sequestration of carbon is incredibly politicized conversation, in part because it affects the coal industry. So if I can put this in perspective a little bit, you've asked about deep sea sequestration of carbon, and absolutely you can do it. But there's a piece of the conversation that comes before that, which is, well, whose carbon dioxide are you putting down there? It turns out the only carbon dioxide that you're talking about is from coal plants. It's from exhaust, from power plants. About a third of the energy budget, maybe more, depending on how you reckon it, is from transport. And we're not talking about putting that carbon dioxide at the bottom because it's too expensive to do it. You only need the CO2 that's concentrated, and that comes out of power plants. So that means that the sequestration conversation is kind of only about half of it. And the problem I have with all of this is that people don't understand that this is such a big problem that solving, getting rid of half of it does nothing. You have to stop it all, or you've done nothing. And the reason why is because it's cumulative. When you're talking about stopping carbon from getting into the air, the conversation you need to have is about the carbon that you didn't capture. You see what I'm saying? So it turns out at least a third of that is intractable, and that is from cars. One of the things you worry about is that this whole conversation might be implicitly about something else, which is warfare between the natural gas and coal industries. Coal industries want to keep their business. The natural gas people want to take it. And one of the grounds on which they take it is that they make a lot less CO2 than the coal people do per amount of energy that you use. Since all this stuff is highly political and somewhat secretive, I can't weigh in on what I think the answer is. I'll tell you and your listeners to just be on the lookout for stuff that doesn't make sense, because there might be a landmine there.
Good warning. Well, Robert B. Laughlin, you're an award-winning professor of physics. Usually the physicists I talk to like nuclear power as a solution. Some even love it with a passion. Where do you fit in that spectrum?
A little background that'll help you understand this. It turns out I'm one of the few physicists you will meet who spent time behind the fence. So I have education in not only things nuclear, but things nuclear that have to do with warfare. Now, with that revealed, my take on nuclear power is that it's political. In other words, that because of the history of nuclear power, it's publicly owned, functionally publicly owned. It has to do in the United States with the Atomic Energy Act, but it's true in all countries. So nuclear power is different from fossil power. It's a public decision, whereas fossil power is a private decision. Now, the way the winds are blowing right now is that the public is pretty evenly split about nuclear power. And that means we've got ambiguities. So the German vote was awfully close, and I actually called it the other way. But then I didn't count on the Japanese having the second worst nuclear disaster in all of history. And that swung it just over the edge. And so it went the other way. The thing I say as a sort of peripatetic scientist is that you have to understand that nuclear energy is fossil energy. It's not carbon fossil energy, but it's definitely fossil in that it's from fuel that's in the Earth's crust that you're burning up. And the amount of it in the crust is finite. Now, exactly how much there is, you have to estimate. There's quite a lot, actually. But you ask how many years we're talking. Well, not much, okay? The amount of uranium-235 in the crust estimated by the IAEA is about the same amount of energy as the coal in the Earth's crust. That means if you sort of keep going the way you're going, the two crises come at the same time, historically, about two centuries out, where the coal runs out and the uranium runs out at the same time. You can make the uranium last longer by doing breeding. People don't like breeding, though, because there's an engineering hook on it, which is the reactors are more dangerous. So you'll find that the whole nuclear conversation is mixed up with the fossilness of the nuclear supplies, with the danger of radiation and how you risk that, and also national security of various countries. For example, the Indians have about 40% of the world's thorium. So right as of this moment, the Indian government loves nuclear power, and they're designing thorium reactors. Well, the fine print there is that all of these reactors are breeders. You have to make a breeder reactor with thorium, and that means that all of the planned thorium burners that the Indians have on the table have potential safety problems. Now, that's not stopping them, but you have to sort of wait until something happens before you really will know what the public policy is in India. As of this moment, the nation that uses the most nuclear power is the USA, by a lot. France has a bigger proportion of its electricity generated by nuclear power, but it's a smaller country. So the big nuclear power user is the USA, followed by France and Japan. What I'm hearing from colleagues in China is that they have decided to go nuclear. They haven't been dissuaded at all by the Fukushima accident. And in fact, students we have here from Kazakhstan report that they're regularly trained. All the uranium ore trains that used to go up to Moscow are now going east to China. So my take on the nuclear stuff is that it's complicated, it's political, there are pros and cons, and no, it won't save you for tens of thousands of years. That's nonsense.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Nobel laureate and Stanford physics professor Robert B. Laughlin. We're talking about his book, Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow. Robert, you write, after the coal runs out, nuclear power will battle it out with solar power. What's the matter with solar power?
It's just cost. Now, you say just cost. The history of energy use by advanced countries has always been a story of cutthroat competition. That's the way it's always been, and that's the explanation for why it's relatively cheap. You see, something so important to you, you'd expect that the market value would be really high. But it's also the case that there's a lot of supply, and the suppliers are busy trying to get your business, and so that brings the price down to what you can bear. Now, all of the alternate energy conversations that one has must start from that. The fundamental reality of the energy market is that it's hyper-competitive, and that people are busy making warfare on each other and destroying each other's companies on the basis of very tiny profit margins. So the technical means to make the energy that you need exist. We talk about the total amount of sunlight raining down on the Earth. It's way in excess of what you need to save civilization. This is one of the reasons that most physicists are optimistic about the future. When people get desperate enough, they can do it. You can do it technically. To me, there's no question that the energy supplies will be there when you need them, and that civilization in the long run will be okay. Human beings will be okay, and they'll have the energy supplies they need to live. What is not so clear is whether you're going to burn up all the coal and oil first. The present trajectory is, my read on it, is that one will. It's a matter of timing what will happen. Now, I talk about the battling out of nuclear power. This is designed to shock people, especially my friends who are so anti-nuclear, they can't see straight. They say, well, let's just use the sun. Well, I say, well, thank you very much, people, but what you have to understand is that all human beings are selfish. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect those people of the future to vote for power that's five times more expensive to save the Earth. What I mean by reasonable is I don't think they'll do it. My experience with things political is it's much easier for people to invent a fiction about why what they're doing is right than it is to do the actual right thing. So I could easily see the anti-nuclear movement today getting turned around in the future by people who are desperate for power, because they just do a little calculation. all they have to do is rewrite history. It doesn't require any money, and the electricity bills fall by a factor of five. And you just declare that nuclear energy was the right thing to use all along, and that those people of the past were deluded. Well, unfortunately, that's what often happens in political situations when people get tighted. So, yeah, I think that even though nuclear energy is on the ropes right now, you have to look at the future very realistically and think, what will happen? What's going to happen when the fossil supplies begin to flag and there's a price competition? What are your great-great-grandchildren actually going to do? And I think you need to take seriously the possibility that they'll just revise your worldview and burn up all the uranium.
I agree that people are greedy, but they also have other emotions, and one of them is fear. And what I'm seeing now in the nuclear industry is that nobody's really changed very much after Fukushima. We've still got the same sort of dangerous reactors. I think there's 23 of those Mark I's running in the United States right now. So all we need is a couple more explosions, and then we need some time to see how many people get sick from it. Maybe people will, out of fear, rewrite that history and not go there.
No, they might. Let me tell a little story. I was in Germany, I'm going to say 2 years ago, and I was talking with a high-level ministerial person at a dinner. And I said, I'd just written a book about energy, and there's a chapter on nuclear energy in it. She says, well, we're trying to get rid of nuclear energy. And I said, okay, that means more Russian natural gas. Whereupon she changed the subject. Now, I relate this story to my German friends. They get a big smile on their face because they know what's going on here, that there is denial on the part of people that the reason you can talk about getting rid of nuclear energy is that there are cheap alternatives. In fact, the energy bill would probably go down if you got rid of the nuclear reactors because they're kind of expensive compared to the fossil fuels. Germany, you know, is a big coal burner, so that's another part of the calculus that's rather complicated. But the whole conversation about how energy is conserved and that you don't have immaculate conception of it, and that if you shut down one source of it, you have to get the energy from somewhere else. The conversation is so dysfunctional that you can't talk about that. You're going to shut down the nuclear reactors, but where is the energy going to come from? We live in an era where the actual energy itself is still really cheap. In fact, it's arguably the cheapest it's ever been, especially in natural gas sector in the USA. And so an anti-nuclear conversation is really a pro-gas conversation. And most people are okay with that because natural gas is mostly hydrogen, and so it's not as big a carbon problem as the other stuff. But that begs the issue that it's going to run out. Not tomorrow, but eventually it'll run out. Whereupon, what are you going to do? Therefore, I think that the real conversation about nuclear energy hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet, and it won't happen until things get tight in the oil and gas market. Then the conversation will get earnest, because it will be then a trade-off not between nuclear energy and cheap gas, but nuclear energy and very, very, very expensive electricity. That's a different conversation.
I hate to agree with you, but I think that gas is really problematic. First of all, fracked gas, there have been studies out showing that there's enough leakage in the whole process, including the delivery and storage system, that you might as well be burning coal. So it's not that great a solution anyway once you start fracking for it. And the second thing is that they have to keep drilling more and more and more and more wells, because gas runs out so quickly. It doesn't just sort of decline the way an oil well does. It's there, and then it's not there, and that could happen to the whole darn industry. So we may be in for a shock on this gas dependence.
It might. That anecdotal rumors that I'm hearing, yes, are that the fracked wells peak more rapidly than the traditional deep wells do. Traditional deep wells of gas are like oil wells. They have long peaking tails. But it's very hard to back up this short peaking story with data because the industry is too young. So I think it's right, but I'm not 100% sure. Fracking has opposition, political opposition from various sources, and you're quite right. There are environmental issues, and there's how much methane you're putting in the air, and so on. And so that's a conversation we have, whether you're going to have laws that regulate the use of natural gas. Those are conversations that are now happening. But in North America, at least, What has happened is that natural gas is so cheap that nobody's fracking for it anymore. They can't make money. So the fracking activity for gas has basically come to a screeching halt because the market price of gas went down to one half of what it should have been, what it was before, and the drillers can't make money. All those people have now gone off into what's called the tight oil market, and they are trying to go back to old wells that have pooped out and use these new technologies to pull out the remaining oil from the reservoirs there. Because of the political lay of the land, this is something I think that's just going to work out. And we'll see. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's infinite gas in the ground and they can just keep drilling and everybody will be energy independent forever because of the gas. I suppose it's possible. But my money says that this is a fantasy. My guess is that it's a fantasy, and what will happen is that there'll be a 10 to 20 year peaking tail associated with these new technologies that will then poop out, and then sort of towards the middle of the century, one will be back to where one was in the early 90s.
Well, in the end, however many years from now, your future humans have electricity and cars and airplanes simply because we love them so much. And as an environmentalist, I was really annoyed by such blatant assumptions until I came to think, well, you're creating a kind of public mirror. That is what we all think. At least that's the way the government acts. And if we're honest, even environmentalists, they buy cars they hope will last 20 years without too many repair bills. So maybe it's time to come clean a little bit, Robert Laughlin. Is this book, Powering the Future, a little bit like Jonathan Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal? Are you baiting us a little?
I don't think so. I'm asking people who are really worried, you know, who love the Earth as I do, to think realistically about what's going to happen. There are a lot of people, especially in the 20 crowd, you know, the student crowd, who think that the world is coming to an end and that you have to make drastic changes in governance in order to stop it. Now, what I try to tell these folks is that after you've lived a long time, what you see is that the human nature comes out of the box. You don't program that. It's people come out of the box where they are, and so your great-grandchildren who don't exist yet are going to be like you, and they're going to love life, and they're going to, when they do this living, they're going to be a burden on the Earth just like you are, and they're going to have to make environmental compromises just like you do, and this is a conversation of all eternity. In other words, you're not going to pass a law tomorrow and save the Earth. Saving the Earth is an ongoing process that will go thousands and millions of years into the future. Every generation that's born will have to make economic compromises between how well it lives and how much you protect the Earth. There's no quick fix. I want everybody to think about the future in terms of both natural law and the laws of economics. When I talk to student audiences around the world, I typically ask them three questions. I ask them, in this time in the future, after all the fossil fuel is gone, will people drive cars? Will people drive flying airplanes? And will the electricity come on? And it turns out that almost universally around the world, the answer is more or less the same. About 70% of the people say that folks will drive cars. And I ask them why, and it beats around the bush for 10 minutes, and then somebody, usually a young woman, says quietly, because they want them. Whereupon we have a conversation about economics. The fact that some of the things that are destined to happen will occur simply because people want them. And that's something, when you're thinking about actions you must do to save the Earth, that's something you have to think about. Okay? People who are not born yet are going to do things just because they want them. The airplane conversation comes down similarly, about 70%. And there, I ask them, great, why? It's the same answer. And then I ask, well, what's going to fuel the airplanes? And then we have all sorts of silly conversations about sunlight and so forth. And then we hit on the important thing, which is that, well, present-day jet fuel has the most energy per volume and weight allowed by physical law. And so if those people of the future are going to be flying in airplanes, then we're not going to have a carbon-free future. What we're going to have instead is a new industry that grows up that makes the kinds of fuels that you use today from parts that are lying around. This, of course, doesn't pull any more carbon out of the Earth anymore, so there's no CO2 issue there. But there is a matter that you can't demonize carbon completely, per se, when you're thinking about the future, because there will always be carbon-based fuels in the future because they're optimal. And then the final thing is the electricity coming on, and that's an important matter which has to do with politics, is to say that there are pricing things likely to happen in the future that are dictated by what people will vote for. That means that in particular, that this fight I mentioned about the solar energy versus nuclear taking place, there probably isn't any way to revert that, because the political process demands that power be cheap. So once we have that conversation, then we can go and talk about the getting from here to there.
Of course, you're presuming we will have a working political decision where people can vote for things. If we get knocked back far enough on our keisters, we might not be able to make those decisions, especially the big-scale decisions, but we can debate that. I do want to bring up the last 81 pages of the book. These are endnotes, and they're a bit daunting. Some seem to require a science degree to be understood. Others point to research we should all be doing. I'm wondering if somebody actually followed up on those 470 references. Shouldn't they get a degree or something?
I've had interesting feedback from people about those. One fellow wrote and he said, well, I enjoyed the book until I got to those notes. Why did you put all this burden on me to have all these notes there? My editor said, well, this is the best piece of scholarship I ever saw. The real answer here is that I decided to do that to protect myself from political attack. You probably noticed that this is a highly politicized subject, and whenever you make public speech about energy, you're bound to be attacked by somebody, either on the right or the left, even if you're right. So what I decided to do was to put a little bit of armor in the back there. So anybody attacks me for being wrong, I can hammer them into the ground. And what has happened, curiously, is that no one has dared, because stripped of the references, the rhetoric could be spun as meaning you're making apologies for oil companies, or it could mean that you're a crazy left-wing climate person. Now, what I think is that when scholars, people who are professors, talk about energy, you have to zero out all that political stuff. And when I say something is true, there's why. And you're welcome to go check it if you want, or not, as the case may be, but I'm not making stuff up. When I say a thing, I worry that what I've said is wrong, and I go check it. And when I found that I'm right, I document that I was.
I think there's a lot of good things in there. I intend to go diving into some of them. Well, as we wrap up, Robert Laughlin, is there other things that you would like to mention or talk about?
You know, when you write a book, you try to talk about everything you can think of in the prose itself. It's not the world's best medium because people can't talk back to you. In this particular case, the references in the back made feedback from people difficult, okay, that people are afraid to talk to me about it because it's got too much gravity. So I guess my answer to you and your listeners would be that I am not a lion. I love talking about this stuff. I'm as worried as anybody, and I'm trying to find what you might say is the way of the engineer. I am a person who looks at a terrible problem and asks, how do you fix it? And I'm a man also who answers his email. So anybody who wants to talk to me about it, feel free.
I'll challenge you, listeners, should you buy a book knowing it will irritate you or may make you think, and what if it educates you along the way? That is Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow, by Stanford physics professor and Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin. And he's been our guest on Radio EcoShock. You can find links to the book and other notes in my blog at ecoshock.info. Robert, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. This is my seventh year producing radio that matters for nonprofit college and community stations around the world. You can help keep the big ball of earwaves going by offering your support at our website, ecoshock.org. Then share the blog at ecoshock.info and our Facebook page at Radio EcoShock. Now, back to one of our specialties here, keeping up to date with the latest climate science. As Robert W. Service wrote, there are strange things done neath the midnight sun. You are about to learn something new going on, powerful but unseen, in the melting far north. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In the past decade, satellites, scientists, and Aboriginals looking at the Arctic find bigger areas without snow cover for longer periods. Arctic heating is greater there than anywhere in the lower temperate zones where most of us live. A huge portion of planet Earth is frozen, we thought permanently, and calling it permafrost. It's beginning to thaw, and we have fresh science showing new pathways for greenhouse gases that might enter the atmosphere. Just out is this paper titled, Surface Exposure to Sunlight Stimulates CO2 Release from Permafrost Soil Carbon in the Arctic. It was published online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on January 4, 2013. We have the lead author on the line, Rose M. Corey, assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Rose, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I think we have to begin by describing the changes in the landscape that's happening in the Arctic, whether it's Alaska or Canada or Siberia. What is it like there in the area you've been studying?
Well, what we've been looking at are these thermokarst failures, which are giant sinkholes you can think of in the tundra. So what we expected in the past, you know, when we pictured the permafrost warming and the ice melting, is we thought that the permafrost might kind of thaw quietly in place with that ice below ground just, you know, kind of melting. And what's happening increasingly is that ice, that those ice-rich soils, that ice is like structure holding the ground up. And when that ice melts and thaws and disappears, that the structure in the ground is gone. And that causes a land surface subsidence or what we call a thermokarst failure. And if the ground slope is large, that can be this really large, you know, sinkhole where then all of this previously frozen carbon is now mixed up and exposed to the relative warmth and sunlight at Earth's surface.
Okay, well, listeners, thermokarst is spelled with a K in there, and I have seen a video where a Russian researcher was demonstrating these, and there were like puddles or ponds that were kind of first raised up and then falling down all across these treeless flats of Siberia, and that's what you're talking about, is it?
Yes, exactly, yes.
All right. Well, now we've been told there's more carbon in those frozen northern soils than already exists in our atmosphere. Let's step back a little bit. Where did all that plant life come from?
Well, it comes exactly from what you say, vegetation. So plants, as they grow, they take that carbon from the atmosphere. So, you know, through photosynthesis, they take carbon dioxide and turn it into organic carbon, which they store in living organisms, you know, in the plant. And then as plants die and decompose, that organic matter can then be, you know, returned back to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, and that process we call respiration. But say when it's cold and wet or frozen, as it is in the Arctic most of the year, that decay process is very slow. And so you get an accumulation of that organic matter over time.
So this might be over thousands of years or longer even?
Yes, that's right.
Your paper suggests that the release of carbon dioxide or methane is not just a simple process where compact plant life is being exposed and then it somehow just evaporates into the atmosphere. There's a complex process taking place. Could you talk to us about that process?
Yes. Basically, as soon as carbon is unfrozen, bacteria or microbes in the soil can start basically eating or consuming that carbon and turning it into carbon dioxide. That's the process of respiration that I was talking about. But the thermokarst failures, again, they kind of changed the trajectory of the debate of what we think is going to happen. Because, again, once that permafrost soil is warmed up and unfrozen enough, bacteria can start converting that carbon to carbon dioxide. But again, what's happening is that these sinkholes, they mix up all of this carbon, and they sinkholes bring this carbon to the Earth's surface where there's sunlight. And sunlight are photochemical reactions initiated by the ultraviolet portion of sunlight change the chemistry of the organic carbon. And that those changes in the chemical composition of that organic carbon stimulate the bacteria's ability to turn that carbon into carbon dioxide. So in other words, taking that stuff from the dark below ground and giving it a little bit of sunlight means that more of it will be converted by bacteria to carbon dioxide.
And I guess that's some of the big news of this paper. It's almost like there's a new actor, sunlight itself.
That's right, yes.
And did I read this correctly in the paper, and I may have misunderstood this, but it seemed like you were also saying that sunlight itself can release greenhouse gases directly, even without those microbes. Did I get that wrong?
That's correct. No, there can be what we call direct mineralization or photochemical reactions initiated by sunlight and convert the organic carbon directly to carbon dioxide without bacteria being involved, yes.
That role of sunlight combined with microbes and water, it's a bit difficult to understand because I thought bright sunlight might actually inhibit microbial action. So how is that working out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly if you take a, you know, water sample with bacteria in it and, you know, say a very thin layer of water in a petri dish and put it out in sunlight, then yes, you will kind of fry the bacteria basically. But that UV light from sunlight that is, you know, directly harmful to bacteria, it's absorbed by the organic carbon in the water. So the organic carbon is basically like sunscreen for aquatic organisms. And it's that process of absorbing that UV portion of sunlight that alters its chemistry and breaks the organic carbon, say, from larger molecules that maybe can't get across the bacterial membrane into smaller ones that bacteria can more easily or more readily respire to carbon dioxide.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Rose Corey from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She's part of a team trying to unravel what happens as the massive Arctic permafrost begins to melt due to global warming. Corey, I gather you did your base studies in Alaska. Does it matter whether the newly released organic matter is in these thermokarst ponds or whether it's in big streams or in muddy rivers? What did you find out about rivers, for example, on Alaska's North Slope?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that's one, the variability or the potential variability in the response is one thing that we wanted to address in this study, which is why we looked at the three different types of thermokarst failures. They're, you know, we classify them, you know, based on whether they are glacial thaw slumps or erosional gullies, for example. And we sampled these different classes of thermokarst failures on landscapes of different ages in the Arctic, say from younger landscapes formed about 10,000 years ago to much older landscapes formed 2 million years before present. Because we expected that these thermokarst failures on these different age landscapes would have very different soil and water chemistry, say for example like pH or water conductivity. And that's exactly what we found, is that there was large variability in soil and soil water chemistry across these different sites. But what was consistent was the effect of sunlight. So no matter what the soil chemistry was, when this previously frozen carbon is exposed to sunlight at our surface, bacteria are better able to respire it to carbon dioxide. And that means that our results are robust. They're not limited to one type of soil or one type of landscape surface.
Well, I think listeners have to keep in mind this is the land where we can get 24 hours of sunlight practically. I mean, a very powerful sun in the summertime at least. Well, Rose Corey, the climate models suggest the Arctic will become wetter and wetter in the coming decades and maybe centuries. The tundra is going to become almost washed over. Will that increase in rains affect the findings that you're looking at?
Sure, in several probably complicated ways. But probably if it does get wetter, that will probably further drive the transfer of this thermokarst carbon or permafrost carbon from land to water, again, where photochemical reactions may be important. And because it's the UV portion of sunlight, it has to be pretty cloudy, we found in the Arctic, for these photochemical reactions to be shut down. And they're certainly slower when there's less UV, of course, but it's not as simple as, you know, a sunny day versus a partly cloudy or, you know, partly rainy day.
All right. And I'm going to quote now a sentence from your paper developed by your team, and it's worrying me. You conclude, quote, "Our results suggest that photostimulation will rapidly, days to months, increase conversion to CO2 by an additional 40% or more in thawed and released sea compared with that remaining in the dark, and that photostimulated bacterial use of this carbon in natural streams may equal or exceed its degradation in the dark alone." So you're talking about a 40% increase when sunlight is involved. That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, what does that mean to us? What are the importance and consequences of this finding?
Well, again, like I said before, I think it alters the debate on the role of the Arctic in future climate change. So we know how much carbon is stored in these permafrost soils. And again, that's about twice as much carbon as is currently in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. And what we don't know is how and how fast that frozen carbon will be turned into carbon dioxide. And our results show that once this carbon is exposed at the surface, it's more likely that it will be turned into carbon dioxide and released to the atmosphere, where it can then drive and further reinforce warming.
It is a positive feedback loop then.
That's right, yes.
Another one in the Arctic, because there's quite a few there. If you'll hang in with me for a minute, I want to describe an event that's happened several times and then ask you whether this applies to your paper. I recall reporting on a very odd event in the Arctic in 1988 and again in late summer 2005, following some high temperatures and bright sunshine. Canadian researchers on Ellesmere Island found masses of plants, whole landscapes in fact, became detached from the permafrost below, and they slid down into river valleys. Some rivers were blocked. They formed new lakes. Entire ridges appeared. The geography was changed. And I'm wondering if a macro event like that, would that also change the amount of carbon that's going to be released according to the processes that you've studied?
Yes, if I understand you correctly, if there's sounds like kind of a landslide and, you know, movement of carbon, yes, anything that would bring, say, deeper carbon, whether or not it's frozen, but, you know, bring deeper soil carbon into surface waters would facilitate the loss of that carbon to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide through the kinds of sunlight-driven reactions that we are looking at.
Well, Rose Corey, can you talk about the science that you think still needs to be done?
Sure. Well, in my specific area of research, looking at, you know, the chemistry of this organic carbon, we really need to understand how and why bacteria prefer one kind of, you know, molecule of organic carbon over another. This dissolved organic carbon, or the organic carbon that's coming out of these soils that we study, I like to say it's the most complex mixture on Earth. And, you know, it's really the mixture of the decay products of life, of material that was once formerly living. And so you take any water sample and there are thousands and thousands of organic molecules. And we don't know enough about the chemistry to be able to predict which of those molecules will be returned to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide on a timescale that's relevant for carbon cycling. And that requires, you know, work from, you know, organic geochemists and aquatic microbiologists, as well as other people contributing too.
Well, I'm kind of worried that governments and funding institutions may not be putting enough muscle into this. I know the public isn't really concerned about permafrost melting yet, and yet it could really, well, ruin our climate and ruin our lives if it gets out of control and we don't even know about it.
Yes. I mean, that's one thing it's very odd or jarring, I'd say, to work in the Arctic every summer and, you know, to see the thermokarst forming, to look at how they're evolving, say, over time, as well as, you know, look at other changes in the Arctic and then come back home to North Carolina and no one has any idea. And, you know, pictures and movies are great, but I think we need to do a lot more of that. You know, I tell people, I show movies of these thermokarst failures and I say, you know, what would it be like, or how would the debate be different if, you know, we had buildings or homes built on this kind of ground? And, you know, I think there just aren't enough people yet that are, you know, that can make the impact direct in their lives, such that it just doesn't hit home enough.
Right. It's out of sight and out of mind. You've just heard from Rose M. Corey, Assistant Professor in Environmental Sciences and Engineering at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She's the lead author in the new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Its title is Surface Exposure to Sunlight Stimulates CO2 Release from Permafrost Soil Carbon in the Arctic. You can Google that to find out more or check out a few links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Rose, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. The process that might do our civilization in is happening right in your city or region. If we had eyes to see gases, we'd see the carbon and the methane pouring up into the sky from our streets, our tailpipes, our homes, our factories, and our farms, billowing clouds of climate change in the making and very little human change on the ground. Still, green nature pops up in the cracks of the sidewalk. In coming programs, we'll cover action in the big picture and ways a million longing hearts can steer in a different direction, including me, including you. In the meantime, we can always follow the lead of the artists. This summer, a sustainability-based electro-swing ukulele show about permaculture is touring the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. They are from Australia, and they're called the Formidable Vegetable Sound System. When this band plays, people can't stop swinging and dancing. Expect them at the University of Massachusetts, Earth Day, April 22nd, the Glastonbury Festival in the UK, June 26th, and the Shambhala Festival in BC, Canada, August 7th. Get the details at their website at permaculturesongs.com. Their new album will be launched April 6th in Melbourne, Australia. Links in my blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again. Please support the program, spread the word, and join me again next week. Here is Formidable Vegetable Sound System with No Such Thing as Waste.
When I was a little boy, I liked to catch the rain, while people all around my town watched it flow right down the drain. But 'cause our little shed in the bush wasn't on the mains, the only water we had to use was in a tank cooked from the rain. 'Cause there's no such thing as waste, only stuff in the wrong place. No, there's no such thing as waste. Misusing water's a disgrace. Moved to the city, rented a house on my way to buy a bed. Saw one lying on the side of the road, so I took that one instead. And also found a fridge, a couch, and a big old plasma screen, in the biggest pile of thrown out stuff that I had ever seen. But there's no such thing as waste, oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Yeah, that's right, there's no such thing as waste. That old landfill is a disgrace. Found out that diesel cars can run on veggie fat. Bought a truck and hit the road, smelling like fish and chips. I rescued piles of wasted oil from the back of restaurants. I'd be a fool if I bought my fuel when there's oil nobody wants. 'Cause no such thing as waste, oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Yeah, I said there's no such thing as waste. Ideas gotta be replaced. Now we gotta refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Now I get my things out of garbage bins and I compost every crumb. I save my seeds and eat my weeds and feed the leftovers to your mum. Gonna build a house from the rubbish tip, gonna keep this planet clean. Reuse ideas that have been around for years to live within its means. 'Cause there's no
such thing as waste. Oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. We didn't get it, we did. I said there's no such thing as waste.